Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast of excellence. We are talking about The Red and the Black, Book 1, Chapter 13. Seems like cognitive dissonance. Sam, seems like, why am I, this is a weird discussion prompt. Too many big words. Seems like cognitive dissonance is disallowing Madame de Renal to consider the gamble she is taking with her future. I didn't really word that very well. Well, maybe I did word it well, but I didn't really word it very simply. You know what I mean, though. She's denying. She's in denial that she's taking a risk. Al Treat said, I owe it to myself to be her lover because if I ever make my fortune and someone brings up my vulgar post as a tutor, I can explain that love threw me into the position. Sigh. And then this. Neither of them had experienced the same night. No shit. Poor Madame de Renal, I wonder how she would feel about being thought of this way. It's so easy to assume that people feel the same as you do, when you're swept up in a feeling so intense, and both sharing the same things. Many times it would even be the right assumption, but with someone manipulative and secretive, and Machiavellian like Julian, look out. I noticed that Madame de Renal had been truly ill, when Julian was gone, reminiscent of Emma Bovary's illness after her fling with Rudolph ended. Her cognitive dissonance might not be all that dissonant if she really thinks they can just go on flirting and holding hands without any escalation. But when she says, I'll never have to give Julian anything, all I can think is what she has already given, or given over to him, including her physiological well-being. Techrific says social climber doesn't quite encompass the full extent of Julian's sociopathy, and as Nietzsche would have put it, the will to power. Non-creative handle said, yes, this chapter hurt to read. Julian is carrying on with the means of social climbing, whereas this poor woman, who is already treated badly by her husband, is sacrificing herself for a young man who doesn't care about her. I brought up yesterday the likelihood of society's reluctance to accept Julian. It was sad to see Julian thought of that and confirmed that using his relationship with Madame would give him the cheat code to circumvent that. I'm not sure that will yield the results Julian expects, but all the more upsetting to think about how Madame will feel if she finds that out. So he's saying that in the future, when he's successful, if anyone goes, well, why were you just a tutor for this family back then? He'll be able to say, ah, well, you know, I was shagging the madam of the house, so, you know, I was just there because of that. Is that what he's sort of setting up there? He's a real piece of work, this Julian. Real piece of work. Swim said the mama fishy says, the epigraph says, the statement given is not found in St. Raoul's writings. St. Raoul was a polygraph writer. His works belonged to different genres, but he always had an interest in history. After some minor works written in order to win the protection of Louis XIV, he wrote De l'usage de l'histoire in 1671. In this essay, he speaks about the good way of writing history and explains that understanding the facts is more important than facts themselves. In 1672, he published Dom Carlos, subtitled Nouvelle Historique. It's a short novel, or a long short story, which relates to love story of a forbidden passion between Dom Carlos, the son of Philip II of Spain, and his father's wife, Elizabeth of Valois. Saint Raoul mixes politics and love, but love appears much more important. This novel was a hit with high society. Nowadays, French critics see it as an important text in the construction of the French psychological novel. Non-creative handle says, the more I read of this book and become acquainted with Julian, I'm forced to ask myself, who is this protagonist? Who is the protagonist? Is it Julian? Is it Madame de Renal? Do we have one? Is Julian our, I'm using the term loosely, anti-hero? I do hope Julian is the protagonist. That means that we're going to see some growth come from his character. I don't like him, but I do have to remind myself how young he is. Yeah, young and ambitious and foolish. Smart and foolish, you know, at the same time. He's getting a bit too big for his britches, but don't we all at that age, you know? Interesting one, yeah. And I'm just thinking back to Madame Bovary. And that was a real case of, even at the end of the book we were talking about, who was the protagonist of this book? Or who was this book about? Madame Bovary or her husband? You know, he kind of bookended the book, so to speak. There's another one. Anna Karenina was like that to a point. Quite far into the novel, it was kind of like, who, even though the book is named Anna Karenina, it wasn't till like maybe halfway through that she sort of shifted into the main character role. It's kind of a bit of a theme with these novels, to an extent. Or at least it's something we've seen before in the Hemingway list. I think it's gotta be Julian though, right? I feel like we're gonna follow Julian. Yeah. Also, just looking at the blurb of the book, it talks about Julian, so that kind of is a bit of a giveaway that it's a book about young Julian, I suppose. Spoiler, I suppose. But yeah, will we call him an anti-hero? Maybe. Let's read chapter 14. It's called English Scissors. A young girl of 16 had a rosy complexion and she put on rouge. Polidori. That's the epigraph. Epilogue? What's it called? Epicenter? Epigraph. Fuchs' offer had, in effect, robbed Julian of all his happiness. He was unable to decide on it one way or the other. Alas, perhaps I have a weak character. I would have made a poor soldier for Napoleon, but at least, he added, my little intrigue with the mistress of the house will serve to distract me for a while. Happy for him, even in this small matter, his inner feelings corresponded ill with the cavalier language. He was in awe of Madame de Renal because of her lovely dress. In his eyes, this dress was the avant-garde of Paris. His vanity dictated that he leave nothing to chance, or the inspiration of the moment. Basing himself on Fuchs' confidences and the little that he had read about love in his Bible, he made a highly detailed plan of campaign, and since without admitting it to himself he was very anxious, he wrote the plan down. The following morning Madame de Renal was, for a moment, alone with him in the salon. "Haven't you another name besides Julian?" she asked him. Our hero had no idea how to reply to so flattering a question. Interesting there that the narrator kind of answered that question we asked in the previous discussion of who is the protagonist by referring to him as our hero. Our hero had no idea how to reply to so flattering a question. Such a contingency was not prefigured in his plan. If he had not had this stupid notion of making a plan, Julian's lively wit would have served him perfectly well, and surprise could only have added quickness to his perceptions. He responded awkwardly, and regarded himself as even more awkward than he was. Madame de Renal forgave him almost immediately. She saw a delightful candour in it, and an air of candour was in her eyes precisely what this man, in whom people found such genius, lacked. Your little tutor inspires in me deep suspicion, Madame Derville said to her from time to time. I seem to see him thinking all the time and acting only circumspectly. He's very sly. Julian remained profoundly downcast by the misfortune of not having known how to reply to Madame de Renal. A man like me must overcome this setback, and seizing the moment when they were moving from one room to another, he believed it his duty to give Madame de Renal a kiss. Nothing could have been less appropriate, nothing less pleasant for him or for her, nothing more reckless. They were on the point of being seen. Madame de Renal thought him mad. She was frightened and above all shocked. The idiocy reminded her of Monsieur Valenod. What would happen to me, she said to herself, if I was alone with him, all her virtue returned, for love was in eclipse. She managed things so that one of her children was always about her. The day was tiresome for Julian, who he spent the whole time clumsily carrying out his scheme of seduction. He never looked at Madame de Renal without the look being a question. However, he was not fool enough to notice that she was very far from succeeding, even in being agreeable, still less seductive. Madame de Renal could not get over her astonishment at finding him so awkward and at the same time so bold. "It is the timidity of a man, of wit in love," she told herself at last with inexplicable joy. "Can it be possible that my rival has never entertained his love?" After lunch, Madame de Renal returned to the salon in order to receive Monsieur Charcot de Maugiron, sub-prefect of Bray. She was working at a little tapestry frame set very high. Madame Derville was at her side. It was in this position and in full daylight that our hero thought it fitting to put out his boot and press Madame de Renal's pretty foot, whose open work stocking and charming Parisian shoe were obviously attracting the gaze of the gallant sub-prefect. Madame de Renal was extremely frightened. She let drop her scissors, her hank of wool, and her needles, and Julian's movement could pass for an awkward attempt meant to prevent the fall of the scissors, which he had seen sliding down. Happily, the little English steel scissors broke, and Madame de Renal made much of her regret that Julian had not placed himself closer to her. "You noticed the fall before I did. You could have prevented it, instead of which your zeal has only succeeded in giving me a great big kick on the foot." All this deceived the sub-prefect, but not Madame de Ville. "This pretty boy has such clumsy manners," thought she. "Even a provincial capital's notions of good breeding would not forgive such a blunder." Madame de Renal found a moment to say to Julian, "Be more discreet, I order you." Julian realized his awkwardness and was flustered by it. He debated at length within himself as to whether he should resent the phrase, "I order you." He was stupid enough to think she could say, "I order," if it was something to do with the education of the children, but in response to my love-making, equality is predicated. One cannot love without equality. And his mind lost itself entirely in coining commonplaces about equality. He angrily repeated to himself a verse of Corneille, that Madame de Ville had taught him a few days before. "Love creates equalities, but seeks them not." Julian obstinately persisted in playing the role of Don Juan, he who had a mistress and was mortally stupid the whole day. He had only one sensible idea, tired out with himself and with Madame de Renal. He pictured the coming of the evening when they would be seated in the garden, side by side in the darkness with dread. He told Monsieur de Renal that he was going to Verrières to see the curé. He left after dinner and returned only late at night. In Verrières, Julian found Monsieur Chelan busy moving out of his house. He had finally been dismissed, to be replaced by the abbé Maslon. Julian helped the good curé, and had the idea of writing to Fouque that the irresistible vocation he felt for the sacred ministry had at first prevented him from accepting his kind proposals, but that when he came to see an example of such injustice, perhaps it would be more conducive to his eternal salvation not to enter into holy orders. Julian congratulated himself on his subtlety in taking advantage of the dismissal of the curé of Verrières to leave himself an open door for a return into business, should sober calculation triumph over valour in his breast. Alright, there we go, another chapter down. Have your say at the subreddit. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.